Support for 89.7 NPR News comes from the James at Ohio State. The best outcomes for treating cancer come from early detection. The James Cancer Diagnostic Center is designed to provide rapid evaluation and a clear diagnosis to those who suspect they have cancer. Learn more at cancer.osu.edu/diagnosticcenter.
Welcome to All Sides and the Reporter Roundtable, an hour where we catch up on the political news of last week and preview the week ahead. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. Joining me on the roundtable this week, we have Laura Bischoff, state government and politics reporter at the Columbus Dispatch. Welcome back, Laura.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Sarah Donaldson, reporter for Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau. Welcome back, Sarah.
Hey, happy Monday.
And Morgan Trowell, State House reporter for News 5 Cleveland. Welcome back, Morgan.
Happy first snow.
Oh, yes. Ugh. it was just so wet, but it did look pretty, didn't it?
It was beautiful.
I agree. I did the. All right. This just in, it just came over before we went on the air, and NPR just had it in their newscast. The U.S. Supreme Court has turned down the request to consider overturning its landmark decision to legalize same-sex marriage, a case known as Obergefell versus Hodges, and the case has Ohio ties. The court made no comment in declining the petition, which was filed by Kim Davis, a former Kentucky County clerk. Laura, can you talk about this decision for the Supreme Court to say they're not going to take it up? What does that mean here?
Well, it doesn't necessarily mean that they won't take it up under a different case further down the road. But for this particular one, they didn't think it was the right one. This Kim Davis, she refused to issue same-sex marriage licenses back in 2015. I'm not sure when it was. It was prior to that, because the decision, Obergefell versus Hodge, came out 10 years ago in 2015. And she was ordered to pay compensation, I think, to a couple that she denied a license to, and she wants that decision overturned.
Okay.
Anyway, this is, you know, for those who support same-sex marriage and LGBTQ rights, this is a good decision. It temporarily, though, I think, sidesteps the issue. I think that there's still... there could be other cases in the pipeline that could more closely match the effort to overturn Obergefell.
Do you think this came as a surprise to some people? Do you think they thought the Supreme Court might take it up? Or, I mean, you don't know. Yeah.
A year ago, or not a year ago, this past spring, I went and talked to Jim Obergefell, who lives up in Sandusky, about the 10-year anniversary. And I also talked to Elgar Hardstein, who is a civil rights attorney who had been based in Cincinnati for a long time and was the attorney that took that case. And Gerhardstein said he didn't think that the Kim Davis appeal was the right one that to do the overturn if it were ever to come to bear.
If you think about, not to draw like it's apples to oranges, obviously, but if you think about how the right to an abortion was overturned, it wasn't by like revisiting Roe v. Wade. It was through a different case. So you know, it would have taken four justices, I believe, to re-review this case.
Okay.
And I think that we were also thinking that it was a possibility, because back in 2022, when Roe was overturned, as Sarah mentioned, Justice Clarence Thomas had said, he had written that we should be revisiting cases like same-sex marriage, like contraception. So I think that this was something that a lot of LGBTQ plus people were worried about. But as both of my colleagues have mentioned, it likely would not have been this case anyway.
There also, there's 823,000 same-sex married couples in the United States. And so to overturn this landmark decision when people have, you know, organized their lives around this institution of marriages would be a massive... overturn.
And even Ohio, we do not have same-sex marriage on the books. So if this was overturned, it would be illegal.
It's still in the amendment that the voters approved in 2004 is still in the Ohio Constitution, which prohibits same-sex marriage. So if Obergefell were undone, then we would revert to that.
All right. Well, that decision by the Supreme Court just came out this morning. So now we are going to pivot back to their other top story of the day. It is now day 41 of the federal government shutdown, the longest in history. And news of a possible end to the shutdown broke late in the day on Sunday, but it's not a done deal. So as lawmakers negotiate in Washington, it's still a wait-and-see situation for more than a million Ohioans regarding their food assistance. SNAP benefits and who will pay and when is tied up in the courts. So let's just first start with the latest news, though. So late in the day on Sunday, eight Democrats in the Senate struck a deal with Republican leaders on a promise of this future vote on health care if they end the shutdown now. Sarah, this was an announcement, basically, but it's not the end of it. So,
no,
right, yeah.
Because, you know, the Senate, the Congress moves in very procedural and confusing ways. So they'll take test votes and all of these things. The Senate has advanced this deal, as I understand, but it has to go back to the House as well. So, of course, then, you know, Mike Johnson has to decide if he's going to bring it up for a vote. Of course, I think there's some urgency on both sides' parts because SNAP benefits have been in the interim. And then you also think about air traffic control issues starting to rise. I mean, you know, we're getting close to Thanksgiving and a lot of folks fly at Thanksgiving. So I think there's starting to be the longer a government shutdown goes, the more people feel it directly, which is why, you know, my understanding of this deal is based on, you know, I'm not in Congress, I'm reading coverage from fabulous national journalists, but my understanding of this deal is that it's not really far off from what Republicans were offering Democrats 40 days ago. I don't really know that there have been serious concessions made to Democrats to actually end the shutdown. It seems like these eight moderate senators are maybe just worn out.
Laura, what do you make of the idea of it still needing to go to the House and they have to concur and everything? Do you feel like this deal is far from over?
It's not a done deal for sure. I mean, as Sarah said, it's got to go. It's got to return to the House, and then you know they have to come to a compromise version of it, and then Donald Trump has to sign off on it. So the shutdown pain could last a little bit longer. And then the really fun part about this is that it really only kicks it down to like January.
Yeah.
So we could just be on repeat and go through this.
A little Groundhog Day action here.
Yeah, we could just have this government shutdown fund again. I think that Americans are exhausted by this. And the polls show that Americans were blaming Republicans more than Democrats for the pain that they're feeling from the shutdown. But it was the Democrats who, I would say, you know, kind of caved on their side and agreed to work with the Republicans.
And let's talk for a minute about SNAP. Morgan, there's many Ohioans relying on SNAP, and the program is in limbo. There are different sources of money coming from, you know, the city, the county, the state. They're all coming together, but it's not a permanent fix, right?
No, not at all. I mean, we are in so much of a limbo right now with different court decisions on all of this money. I mean, the money comes from the federal government, and it goes to the states, and that's how it ends up getting divvied out. But the thing is when you don't have a clear understanding from the federal government about what they are or aren't allowed to do, including with judges ruling differently from each other, it leaves the people who are, you know, most vulnerable in this position where even if they do get partial benefits, that's not a ton of money, and they've been going without for a significant amount of time.
Yeah, there was so on Friday, maybe there was a federal court judge somewhere who said the Trump administration needs to pay these SNAP benefits immediately, and then the Supreme Court said, well, maybe not immediately. Do I have that right?
I think they kicked it back to an appeals court. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's, you know, courts obviously, even in an emergency situation like this, move. They're going to throw the ball. I think the Supreme Court kicked it back to an appeals court. I cannot remember what Laura is telling me she knows.
Yeah, so Justice Brown Jackson, she had it come to her, and they wanted her to, you know, rule immediately, and she said, basically, let's give the appeals court a little bit more time to discern what all the issues are. It is it's very confusing, I think, for people, because there are these multiple courts, you know, saying you have to fund it fully. And then the Trump administration says, well, you need to clarify your order. And then another court might rule a different way. And it's, you know, in Ohio, there's 1.4 million people that rely mm-hmm. on SNAP benefits. And that's like $263 million a month that comes into the state.
I think something that's really important to point out, and I don't want to look too far to the future, but as you're looking at this debate over state funding and city funding of SNAP in this short period of time, a big change that was made under the Big Beautiful Bill a couple months ago is that Ohio is going to have to start contributing to SNAP as a state. The state does not pay for SNAP. Like, SNAP is a fully federally funded program, which is why it's such a holy crap, SNAP benefits have lapsed because it's 100% federally funded. That Big Beautiful Bill makes changes starting in October 2027 that the state is going to have to contribute money. Ohio is going to have to contribute money if its error rate is above a certain percent. And Ohio's error rate does fall over that percent. So, you know, this does also, you know, this is a, again, an apples to oranges comparison, but it's just important to point out that the state is going to have to start kicking money towards SNAP on a regular basis.
It's almost like the federal government is proving, like, you do have the money somewhere, state, because you found it right now.
I don't know.
All right. Matt Habosh is the CEO of the Mid-Ohio Food Collective, and he recently told reporters this.
Please understand, food banks cannot make up for the loss of SNAP benefits. SNAP, which many of you know as food stamps, is America's first and best defense against hunger.
Yeah, and he also commented last week that more than $1 million combined donations from Columbus and Franklin County is going to help, but it's not enough. I heard on NPR over the weekend an interview with a woman who has been using SNAP, and she went to a food bank on Saturday for the first time in her life because she had always just been able to use SNAP and had never been to a food bank before. So it's not, I think a lot of people don't realize that it's not, it's kind of not the same thing, right?
Yeah, although I think that a lot of people who are on SNAP end up going to the food banks at the end of the month as their funds dwindle.
So Governor DeWine, through an executive order, committed $25 million. Do we know exactly how that money is being used? Is it being used right now, or is it?
He sent out a breakdown of, you know, what services it was going to, but I think that dollar amount, it's, you know, a Band-Aid. It's short. It's not a huge, huge, it sounds like a lot of money, but it isn't like this.
Again, it's $25 million, yeah. And that the amount of SNAP money that comes in from the federal government to Ohio is $263 million. Right. So it's not even a dollar for every $10.
This is the Reporter Roundtable from All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. We are talking with Laura Bischoff from the Columbus Dispatch, Morgan Trow from News 5 Cleveland, and Sarah Donaldson from the Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau. I wanted to jump to some election results. About 6 days ago, Democrats in Ohio had some victories to celebrate from last week's general election. A Dispatch analysis showed that in Franklin County, 53 of the Democratic-backed candidates in contested races won. On the GOP side, 10 of the 35 Republican-backed candidates won. The Democratic Party chair, Kathleen Klein, predicted, quote, "Ohio Democrats are headed to the best election year since 2006. That remains to be seen, but Sarah, do you think her prediction could be true?
I mean, I think it's really, I'm really wary of basing, especially statewide, like we're talking statewide here, 2026, she's talking about statewide elections. Mm-hmm. These were all in Ohio. We just had local elections on the ballot. Like, this was the first time I, as a state issues reporter, didn't have to cover the election in a while because we didn't have marijuana or abortion or something on the ballot. And, you know, New York and Virginia and New Jersey, those states are different demographically than Ohio is. That being said, you know, the midterm election after a president, like when the White House switches parties 2 years after that midterm election, obviously, most of the time, it's good for the opposite party. So for Democrats, you know, Amy Acton is pushing some polls that have her looking pretty okay to Vivek Ramaswamy, like matching up that it would be a pretty close race. But Democrats have not fared well statewide in Ohio in recent election cycles. So, you know, I'm not sure where the chairwoman is, I'm not sure specifically what she's pointing to that makes it look like it's going to be really rosy next year, but Democrats have not fared well statewide.
Morgan, whenever it comes to the election of last week, what were you following? Were you following a lot of the school levies that were around?
Yes. So I did a kind of a deep dive into at least the Northeast Ohio levies, which I think could be a greater look at levies across the state. So in the area, there were 38 school levies that were on the ballot. 23 of them passed and 15 failed. And that might sound really good. And it is good for a lot of those schools. However, when you look at the ones that passed and the ones that failed, the renewal levies, 18 out of 20 times, they passed. Those are levies that don't raise your taxes. Whereas the levies that do raise your taxes, the additional money levies, so out of 10, 7 of them failed. So people, we talked to people who were voting, who after the polls, they were like, look, we support our schools, but we just cannot do this. For some of the schools, like this would have been like Shaker Heights. They passed a levy and this would be $1,000 a year extra for per person.
Oh,
yes.
Wow.
For per property, that would be more than $1,000. So when we look at.
They did pass it.
They did pass it.
Wow.
So I talked with the Shaker Heights superintendent. Shaker Heights is an interesting area because they are very politically involved. They always have been. They have a history of that. Their school has stood up and refused to sign things that the Trump administration has put forward. They actually, the area voted 90% for Vice President Kamala Harris. And so when we look at them, they believe that it's because people are so involved. It's because they know that there's going to be funding shortages. But also they do have an affluent population in certain subsections of that area. Whereas some of the, you know, lower income school districts, most of the time they fail.
I interviewed as a part of my series Untangled, which was on school funding. I interviewed the superintendent for Parma, and theirs failed. I did notice that. They had tried like 10 times or something like that.
It has been since 2011 that they have passed new money. I mean, they have been struggling. I've talked with them extensively. They already had to shut down a school. This is for the schools who are not getting new money. This is a huge struggle, especially because it's going to get even harder. The stakes were super high this election because after this election, they can no longer put emergency levies on the ballot. The lawmakers passed an override to the governor's veto of something in the budget, which said you're restricted from putting certain levies on the ballot. So for Parma, that was able to just continue putting this emergency levy back on the ballot when it would fail, they're no longer going to be able to do that.
And locally here, Olentangy passed a bond issue, so they're going to be able to build some new schools. And then the interesting one was Westerville passed an earned income tax levy, which I feel like school districts like Parma might be taking a look at. Instead of property taxes, Westerville decided to try an earned income tax, and it passed by a higher percentage than I expected. Laura or Sarah, were either of you following that?
I followed a little bit. I think it passed like maybe the
I don't have the number.
District straddles two different counties, so it's like 56 and 60%, something like that.
Yeah,
it's supposed to generate $24 million a year and would avert like 100 staff cuts that they were saying they would have had to make had they not had it pass. What I think is interesting about it is that it targets only earned income, and so it doesn't hit retirees on their pensions or their Social Security. And I think that that's probably a pretty favorable way to package it.
Well, and I think you hear frustration from some retirees who live in communities with high property taxes. A lot of that money does go back to the schools. Some of them feel strongly that their money is going back to the schools, but some of them don't have kids in school anymore. So it's an interesting concept to switch to that, to try out, and it worked in Westerville's favor, that earned income tax levy. I also generally, you know, the statewide, I think levies passed, like two-thirds of the levies that were on the ballot passed. I think that was according to the Ohio School Boards Association. State lawmakers are going to take this and say, see, voters are passing these property tax increases. This is a big reason that Republican state lawmakers have said, you know, we aren't going to provide direct property tax relief because these are voted increases. So, you know, I think this election is going to be used in that way as well.
All right. Coming up, we are now less than 1 year away from the election for Ohio's next governor. And we'll talk about a potential change to child labor laws backed by Republicans that isn't sitting well with everyone. That's when the Reporter Roundtable from All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Sources and methods, the crown jewels of the intelligence community. Shorthand for how do we know what's real? Who told us? If you have those answers, you're on the inside, and NPR wants to bring you there. From the Pentagon to the State Department to spy agencies, listen to understand what's really happening and what it means for you. Sources and Methods, the new national security podcast from NPR.
You're listening to All Sides and the Weekly Reporter Roundtable, an hour where we talk all things Ohio politics. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. Still with us, Sarah Donaldson, reporter for the Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau, Laura Bischoff, politics and state government reporter at the Columbus Dispatch, and Morgan Trowell, statehouse reporter for News 5 Cleveland. We are now less than a year away from electing a new governor in Ohio. Governor DeWine is term limited, and it's shaping up to be a race between Republican Vivek Ramaswamy and former Ohio Department of Health Director Democrat Amy Acton. Former Democratic Congressman Tim Ryan, what happened to him? So basically, he said he'd decide by the end of September and whether he was going to run for governor or not. And then he said he needed a little more time. Well, now it's November. So are we still waiting for an announcement from him, or have we all moved on?
I mean, in terms of are we still waiting for an announcement, I think that that announcement could be I'm not running or I am running. It's still kind of this will he, won't he, I would say, that we kind of dealt with Sherrod Brown in the spring before the former senator jumped into the race against current Republican Senator John Husted. I don't think it's like 100% he's not running. I think that there are signs pointing to the fact that he might still run. But again, it's not much has changed since September.
I know. It's interesting because he did send out a mailer showing his support for food banks. I don't know if that means anything. I wonder if he has any internal polling or advice he's getting right now. Morgan, do you have any thoughts?
Yeah, I think that obviously, you know, the deadline to file is, I believe, February. Mm-hmm. So he has some time. But I mean, this is really trying to get in front of donors, trying to get in front of people that matter, he should be getting in front of voters. And it seems like he's going to a lot of, events at like for Democrats and the party. He's going around with Alison Russo a lot, former House Minority Leader. But we never know with this kind of stuff. I think I agree with Sarah with the fact that it's either he's going to announce that he is or he's going to announce that he isn't. But everything looks like he's gearing up for a run. I mean, sending out his opinion on SNAP is very telling about where he stands. It looks like he is going to run. He's also asked a team of his people to start looking at, you know, what that could look like for him. But we don't know yet.
Yeah. Laura, do you think this is hurting Amy Acton's campaign or people waiting to see what he decides before they endorse her or something like that?
100%. Mm-hmm. I think that the longer he stays out, it's a problem for the Democratic Party because they already had a costly primary between Nan Whaley and John Cranley the last time. Mm. Neither side wanted to team up. It seems like we're seeing a repeat of that this time. And I think that Tim Ryan, maybe he'll get in. In the meantime, it inhibits Amy Acton's ability to raise money. Mm-hmm. Is the specter of is he in or is he out?
And I feel like I've said this time and time again because I've been on this show multiple times as he's been will he, won't he. But when you look at the other side, Republicans have completely coalesced, statewide Republicans, mm-hmm. elected officials have completely coalesced around Vivek Ramaswamy for governor. You know, Attorney General Dave Yost ran and dropped out. Lieutenant Governor Jim Tressel was maybe going to run and then said he wasn't running. And that's in part because the Republican Party chose to endorse Vivek Ramaswamy months ago. And he's also running with the party's money.
So Ramaswamy, on X was very candid about Tuesday's election results. He posted a video in which he says, basically, we got our butts handed to us in New Jersey, Virginia, and New York. I used a more family-friendly word, but yes, he said we got our butts handed to us. And then he went on to say this.
Number one, our side needs to focus on affordability. Make the American dream affordable. Bring down costs, electric costs, grocery costs, healthcare costs, and housing costs, and lay out how we're going to do it. And number two, cut out the identity politics. It doesn't suit Republicans. It's not for us. That's the woke left's game, not ours. We don't care about the color of your skin or your religion. We care about the content of your character. That's who we are.
So, yeah, Laura, what do you make of Ramaswamy's comments? I mean, he didn't go along the party line, basically. He was saying that it was things did not look great and he wasn't happy.
I think it's kind of a smart pivot to the center, you know, as he, you know, positions himself into the general election, because he doesn't have to appeal to the base. He's got the nomination is pretty much his. I think focusing on pocketbook issues is something that Americans would really like to see from both parties. What's interesting, though, is that this message kind of runs counter to the GOP playbook. That has been, you know, a favorite play for the last several years. You know, Republicans say that they care about economics, but their main strategy is, you know, focusing on tax policy and lowering taxes.
This is the Reporter Roundtable from All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. We are talking with Laura Bischoff from the Columbus Dispatch, Megan Trow from News 5 Cleveland, and Sarah Donaldson from the Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau. Republican lawmakers want to extend the hours that 14-year-olds and 15-year-olds in the state can work. So, Sarah, why are Republican lawmakers so keen to make this change? Why do they want the kids to work more?
So the argument here, and to be clear, so the change that they are pushing for can't be done unless the federal government rolls back the Fair Labor Standards Act. They want 14 and 15 year olds to be able to work from 7 p.m. to 9 p.m. year round. Right now, 14 and 15 year olds can only work from after 7 and until 9, like on holiday breaks and over summer vacation. They argue, Republicans argue, that, you know, this may ease some labor force woes. On the flip side, Democrats, who mostly voted against this effort because it was a bill and then also a resolution asking Congress to roll back that Fair Labor Standards Act for this specific change, Democrats say that most of our needed jobs in Ohio, the most in-demand jobs, kids aren't going to be filling, like jobs in healthcare or like, you know, a 14-year-old's not going to be working as a plumber at between 7 and 9 p.m. So kind of an interesting argument, interesting debate on the floor. Governor DeWine was asked if he would sign this. And again, the state can't, like, make this change without the federal government doing anything about it. But DeWine was asked about this, and he was kind of wishy-washy about whether he would sign it. But that's pretty typical DeWine.
Are other states trying to do this, too? Like, why are we?
Yeah, so from a national perspective, over the last 5 years, there have been efforts to both, like, strengthen child labor laws and also whittle down child labor laws. Different efforts, like with work permitting, you know, kids under 16, the hours that they can work. I mean, there's been different efforts, but this is more of a national push, I would say.
Okay. So, but basically, even if Ohio passes it, the federal government has to do something or else it's not actually true.
Yeah. Yeah. Congress would have to, again, vote to make this change.
Congress is notoriously doing a great job right now. So, yeah.
They're obviously doing a lot right now.
Yeah. All right. And then I wanted to move on to redistricting. Two Democrats on the Ohio Redistricting Commission are getting some heat from a lot of different groups for voting with the Republicans to pass congressional maps. Here is Senate Minority Leader Nikki Antonio defending her vote.
Democrat representation in Ohio would have been decimated. And in the process, the people we fight for would have been left behind. Facing this impossible challenge with no certain path to preserve a fair map, we work towards compromise. But I understand and appreciate the anger we've heard from Ohioans today in this room. Because you know what? I'm angry too.
So do you feel like the Democrats, Morgan, do you feel like the Democrats are going to be facing this for a while? I mean, these maps are in place now for a few years, and they voted for it, the two of them on the commission. Is this going to be an issue for a while, or are people going to forget about it?
So I think that they're... If you ask the general public of Ohio what they think about redistricting, I don't think people are going to have an opinion because it is so complex. It's not an issue that comes up in, I think, everybody's daily life. However, for the people that really care about redistricting, which you should really care about redistricting, I think that people have, I've seen people start to kind of change their opinion because the Democrats didn't lose as much as they could have. And the Republicans said that. And the Republicans said that they didn't go as hard as they could have because they were worried about a referendum. And the Republicans are getting a lot of flack online as well. They're getting just as much, if not more, from national Republicans saying you guys could have had a way stronger map. But instead, you know, you're going to have toss-up districts, or, you know, Amelia Sykes's seat in District 13 is looking a little bit more blue. Marcy Kaptur's seat is in Northwest Ohio, is going to be more red, but it was already a red district. And then you have Greg Landsman down in Cincinnati area, who is going from a toss-up blue seat to a toss-up red seat. I mean, obviously, those, I can't imagine that those members of Congress are happy about it, but they could have gotten a lot worse maps. Hmm.
And Laura, this map is in place. Is it for 6 years, Sarah?
Yes, 6 years.
6 years. Okay, 6 years. So this is our map for a while now. Laura, what do you make of this, the commission voting all together, like, not very harmonious, but it's, you know, on paper.
I honestly think the Democrats were kind of between a rock and a hard place. And you know, this was the best they could get, which is to put Landsman kind of into a red district. And Marcy Kaptur, you know, she's the longest serving woman in the U.S. House. And if anybody has a chance of eking out a victory in a red district, maybe it's her. We'll see.
I think the frustration that you hear from folks on the ground who are criticizing Democrats comes especially from the fact that they are voting for maps that these folks feel are gerrymandered. But both parties, both Republicans and Democrats, when they get into the redistricting commission stage, they're thinking about how they can protect their side more. And these redistricting advocates are coming from a place of, well, these districts should be compact as possible and they should take communities into consideration. But that's not the game that's being played in Ohio, and that's not the game that's being played nationally, because it's not illegal to gerrymander on a partisan scale, and both sides do it in states across the country. And President Trump has asked Republicans to pick up as many districts as possible. And then on the flip side, California just voted to throw out their independent redistricting commission's map for this one time only to pick up blue seats. So, you know, this is not happening in a vacuum. And I think it's pretty notable that Ohio is the only state so far that's had a bipartisan vote.
And I think that there's also the redistricting advocates, or people who just say that they're like regular citizens who are upset about these maps on either side, are upset about the process. It was not transparent. That's just a fact. I mean, they introduced the map. It wasn't even online until 5 minutes into the meeting that they were introducing it. And so a lot of the people who were testifying said, like, I don't even know what to say about this map because I'm just seeing it for the first time on this poster board that you just put up. So I think that the transparency aspect is another reason why the public is frustrated with the lawmakers, especially Democrats.
One final topic I wanted to get to before we took a break is an interesting moment in the U.S. Senate. It was kind of a bizarre admission from Ohio Senator Bernie Moreno that was made last week during a routine Senate confirmation hearing. Let's listen.
Would it surprise you that I got the VIN numbers of every one of my Democrat colleagues' vehicles and found that none of them bought any of the additional safety technologies on their cars?
And then he made that comment. Democratic Senator Jackie Rosen from Nevada responded with this.
I object to you stalking my car and my staff to find the VIN numbers to present to this committee. What are you doing there? What are you going to do with them? It's an invasion of our privacy. If you came and asked me for my VIN, I will tell you what I have in my car.
It's visible. It's visible from the outside of the car.
So you went and followed me. That seems a little creepy.
Just to expose the hypocrisy.
This was such an interesting and bizarre exchange. What was Moreno's justification why he wanted the VIN numbers of the senator from Nevada's car?
I think the senator from Nevada. It has to do with some safety features.
Features that drive up the cost of vehicles.
Yes, and Moreno's been arguing against them. And of course, if
Moreno's a car guy, so
I was going to say, if anyone's going to know how quick and easy it is to grab a VIN number from a car, it's going to be a long time car salesman. Moreno owned a chain of car dealerships. These types of moments in Congress are splashy and they happen. I'm sure if I was asked, would it surprise you that I got your VIN number, my answer would be yes, because I don't know why anyone would be looking for my VIN number. Yeah. But that being said, I'm sure he was probably going for a soundbite in that moment, because it is a pretty aggressive
don't think that was the soundbite he was seeking, though. To be called creepy.
No, it maybe did turn around. Maybe it did blow up in his face a little, because it has been posted across the country. But I think
It was a longer exchange, and she basically was like, "My car is in my garage in my home in Nevada," and he's like, "Well, no, not that car." And then she's like, "Oh, my staff." It goes back and forth for a while. basically, he was trying to prove that the cars she drives in doesn't have these safety features that she wants other cars to have, and it's expensive to add these safety features. So that's what he was trying to prove, that if she doesn't need the safety features, why does anyone need them?
I think, Laura said, though, if you're trying to make a point, if you have to explain your point to that point, and it comes out, the headline is instead, someone
creepy.
Else calling him
Bernie
creepy.
Moreno gets called creepy.
I don't know. I'm not the one doing messaging for either of them.
Morgan, you want to weigh in on Bernie Moreno, or is that enough?
I think they covered it. Look, sometimes politicians, they will make things that they think that it's like a good point, like to expose hypocrisy or something like that, and then it ends up kind of blowing up in their face because it's the optics of it.
Yeah.
It's like, you might be right, but the optics are weird.
Yeah. I also don't know if he himself went and looked at the VIN number, or if he had like a staff member. That's kind of
imagine that Senator Bernie Moreno was walking through the garage of Congress checking out people's dashboards, but maybe he was. I don't know.
The government's been shut down, so
I don't know.
He's got the time. All right. Well, coming up, we're going to get an update on the state teachers' retirement system board controversy. That is when the Reporter Roundtable from All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Sources and methods, the crown jewels of the intelligence community. Shorthand for, how do we know what's real? Who told us? If you have those answers, you're on the inside, and NPR wants to bring you there. From the Pentagon to the State Department to spy agencies, listen to understand what's really happening and what it means for you. Sources and Methods, the new national security podcast from NPR.
You're listening to the All Sides Weekly Reporter Roundtable. I'm your host, Amy Jarovich. With me in the studio today, Morgan Trowell, State House reporter for News 5 Cleveland, Laura Bischoff, State Government and Politics reporter at the Columbus Dispatch, and Sarah Donaldson, reporter for the Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau. Ohio saw a big jump in domestic violence deaths over this past year. 84% of the fatalities involved guns. And Sarah, you wrote about a bipartisan bill called Break the Silence that relates to these domestic violence numbers, but also intimate partner violence. Can you tell me more about this initiative?
Yeah, this bill comes from an idea from a woman who's a survivor of domestic violence. She went to Representative Dontavius Gerrells, he's a Democrat, and told him when she was being abused, her abuser would often accompany her to her doctor's appointments. Mm. And, you know, the doctor would often ask, do you feel safe at home? But her abuser's kind of hanging right over her shoulder. So this bill, it's also sponsored by Representative Josh Williams. He's a Republican. The bill's intention is just to create a standard of care and add some additional policies for healthcare facilities like hospitals, urgent care facilities, for how they treat a patient who they suspect is currently being abused. So one of those things is, instead of asking in the room when there are other people in the room, you know, asking them privately, mm-hmm. taking them and interviewing them, and then also asking the people who accompany them to the appointment, because sometimes if they go to the hospital, they might have a family member who is with them who can potentially speak to what might be going on behind mm-hmm. the scenes. Also adds a requirement that practitioners who suspect that abuse is happening document that person's injuries that might be connected to domestic violence and add that to their medical record.
So this bill, does it have to do with the statistics that came out, or is it just all, you know, it, does it relate, or is it just kind of like it happened to be at the same time?
Well, I think the state, you know, works closely at times with the Ohio Domestic Violence Network. You know, they've had some legislative wins in the past on like AirTag legislation and things like that. So I think, you know, lawmakers trying to defray domestic violence in whatever way they can is a pretty consistent and ongoing issue in the state.
All right. Laura, I wanted to move to the State Teachers Retirement System Board, which oversees about $100 billion invested on behalf of 500,000 teachers and retirees. It's embroiled in controversy. Can you give us an update? There was a trial in late October, right?
Yes, in Franklin County Common Pleas Court in front of Karen Held Phipps. This was a bench trial, a civil case, and it's the attorney general trying to remove the chairman of the board, Rudy Fichtenbaum, and block him from returning to the board, as well as block former board member Wade Steen from ever serving on the board again. And the crux of it is whether or not they violated their fiduciary duty by working in concert with this startup company called QED that was founded by Seth Metcalf. He served in Josh Mandel's administration in the state treasurer's office.
That's a name from the past. All right, there you go.
Yeah.
Right.
And so it was a 5-day trial. I honestly think that the judge probably had to chug a whole gallon of patience to sit through very tedious testimony. I went to the court one day, and then I listened to it online a couple days. Morgan, she had more penance than I did.
Were you in the room where it happened, Morgan?
Oh, I was in the room where it happened, and I sat through it. And yeah, it was tedious. The judge got involved at several points and said, "I need you to be brief." Or like she would interrupt and talk to the witnesses and say, "Okay, you know what? This line of questioning, we're just going to ask you very, very clearly. Like, what is this? What is this?" Because the attorneys were kind of being long-winded and not getting to the point of their questions.
There was a whole lot of, you know, you ask what time it is and then they explain how a watch is built kind of stuff. Very, very
Was this a
detailed.
Strategy? Were they trying?
No.
Or this
I don't
is,
know.
I mean, I said no, but
what's interesting is the judge has yet to issue a ruling on the case. Mm. Each party has will be allowed to do their closing arguments on paper with a 30-page limit.
oh heavens! Okay.
And I think they're waiting for the transcript for the mm-hmm. trial, which I think is about 1,500 pages.
Oh,
so
no.
It's going to take a long time to produce that, and then they'll have like 10 days after it's mm-hmm. after the transcript is available to then submit their briefs, and then the judge then will digest it and make a decision at some point after that. So we're not looking till like I don't know. I would say mid-December, maybe.
I would say, yeah.
So right. this is separate from another lawsuit
mm-hmm.
In which the teachers' unions are challenging a change to state law that was made in the budget bill in the middle of the night to reconfigure the makeup of the board, to take political power away from elected teachers and retirees, you know, people who are mm-hmm. elected to the board, and then shift the balance of power to political appointees.
Now, I mean, we're joking around about this trial being long and tedious, but it involves a lot of money and a lot of people, like in the end, right?
Oh, yeah. So this involves allegedly a $65 billion corruption scheme, alleging that the board members and, well, Rudy Fichtenbaum, the board chair, and Wade Steen, the former appointed board member, were colluding with QED, and that they were doing anything they can to get this investment firm that the AG's team says has no clients, no track record, just started, didn't have the capability to even invest the money. They're saying that this was a whole plan because they had personal ties to both, like, to all the people who were involved. And, you know, there are hundreds of text messages that were used in court that show that they were using Signal, which is an encrypted app that deletes even after you read a message, but you can subpoena, and that's how they got the messages, because nothing's ever really encrypted. So it's showing that Seth Metcalf and J.D. Tremel were legitimately texting questions for Wade Steen to ask during board meetings, and he did. It shows that they were creating documents for them to propose, and they did. So the state is saying that they breached their fiduciary duties by a number of ways, such as, you know, favoritism, bias, proposing other people's plans, sharing confidential documents that Wade Steen said that he didn't believe were confidential.
All right. Well, I guess we'll just wait until the long trial, and then the other trial will still be happening. All right. Well, we'll have to stay tuned. This is the Reporter Roundtable from All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking with Megan Trow from News 5 Cleveland, and Laura Bischoff from the Columbus Dispatch, and Sarah Donaldson with the Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau. And there was a bill that would give local taxing authorities the power to block library levies from the ballot. Why is this piece of legislation? Like, what is this piece of legislation? What would it do? Did you write about that, Sarah, or no? Morgan?
I can talk to it, and Laura can also talk to it. Basically, what this legislation does is prevent, like you said, it allows for a county and officials to not put a library levy on the ballot. We know that of all the levies, libraries pass the most, and basically what they're saying is people cannot afford to keep putting these up, so we're just going to take them off.
And Morgan, I called you Megan twice. I'm so sorry. I had no idea. It doesn't. I had
Don't
no.
Worry about
I am
it.
So sorry.
It's so fine.
You are Morgan.
Yes, I am.
And you are, and there is no Megan here. And sorry. Okay. Continue.
Not to be confused with Megan Henry.
Yes, there is a Megan.
My colleague.
She's not here right now. I'm so sorry, Morgan.
No,
okay.
It's fine.
Yes. What do you want to add about libraries?
No, I was just going to say the Ohio Library Council put out a press release after Tuesday's election results and showed that the libraries are batting 900 on library levies. 18 of 20 passed statewide.
All right. And then there was one other. We're running out of time, but I wanted to get to another story that Central State University, Laura, I think you wrote about this. Central State University in Ohio is the only public historically black college, and it was placed on a fiscal watch list about a year ago. The university is seeking $4.2 million in help from the state. Do we have any updates on that?
The controlling board meets at 1:30 today, and we'll see if they get everything they're asking for. What's interesting is 30 years ago when I first moved to Ohio, Central State was a big story. My colleagues at the Dayton Daily News were covering it, you know, very thoroughly. And it seems like every 10 years there's some sort of fiscal crisis with this small university. Mm-hmm. They were put on fiscal watch in 2005 and then 2015 and now 2024. Mm-hmm. So there's some sort of, you know, issues that need to be remedied. Governor DeWine was pretty shocked at the level of deferred maintenance on all these buildings. They had an outside contractor that was supposed to be doing all the maintenance, and then they were upcharging for maintenance items that should have been covered by the basic contract. So that's a big problem. There's a dormitory that houses like 380 students, and it doesn't have a working fire alarm.
Oh, no.
Which, if you think about it, that's just a disaster waiting to happen.
Yeah.
I mean, kids in dorms light candles. They use hot plates.
Popcorn.
Oh,
no. Popcorn.
I mean, honest to God. And the governor was like, that's horrible. You can't make that. You can't let that happen. And put the state fire marshal on it right away. And they were told they had to hire people to walk the halls 24/7.
To make sure nothing was on fire.
Conditions. Yeah, wow. until they fix it. And the fire alarm, fixing the fire alarm, I know is one of the top priorities.
Okay. Well, we are down to only a minute left. So one of you has a chance to just tell me, what are you going to be looking at? Sarah, can you tell me what's going on this week? Are they meeting about marijuana maybe or hemp?
Yeah, lawmakers still need to go behind closed doors and hash out a deal on marijuana and hemp legislation. They've been debating this in fits and spurts since December 2023, so going on 2 years now. So I'm skeptical until something's actually on its way to the governor at this point, but I know Speaker Matt Huffman has said he'd like to get it done before Thanksgiving.
Okay, so either this week or next week.
Yes.
All right. Well, we have been having the reporter roundtable from all sides today. I want to say thank you to our guests. Sarah Donaldson, reporter for the Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau. Thanks for being here, Sarah.
Thank you. Safe travels out there, Columbus.
And Laura Bischoff, politics and state government reporter at the Columbus Dispatch. Laura, thanks for being here.
Oh, thank you.
And Morgan Trowell. I am so sorry, Morgan. Morgan Trowell, State House reporter for News 5 Cleveland. Thanks for being here, Morgan.
Of course. Thanks for having me.
And this has been All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. I'm Amy Jurevich.